Welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Magda Zenon recording from downtown Nicosia, and with me in my virtual studio, I have Dr. Smadar Ben-Natan, all the way from San Francisco. Or where are you based?
No, I'm in Seattle, Washington.
Oh, there, right, you're now in Seattle, Washington. Smadar has got a CV as long as my arm. So I will just introduce her as she's Israeli, she's an international lawyer, and she is the things that pulled me to want to her to speak to us is that she discusses the military courts in Israel and Palestine and the connection between international law and implementation of international law. Smadar, the floor is yours. Tell me what else you want listeners to know about you. Unless you want to go straight into the conversation.
Well, I could say that I am Israeli. I've been living in the United States for over 8 years now, and I currently teach global studies and human rights at the University of Oregon. And my research is about the Israeli military courts and the incarceration of Palestinians by Israel. And of course, it stems from my work as a lawyer in Israel-Palestine, where I practiced both in the military courts and also represented many Palestinian prisoners.
There are so many things that can be discussed around what you are researching. Let's start at the one thing that has always bothered me during the years of this conflict, because my background and interest in the subject is that in 1981, I'm an old broad, when I did my master's dissertation under Professor Dugard, who was on the International Court of Justice legal team for South Africa, my subject was wars of national liberation, are they legitimate or legal under modern international law, a case study for Palestine. So I've always been interested, concerned, aware, angry, the whole range of it. The thing that's always bothered me is that the IDF constantly arrests underage young Palestinian men, 13, 14, 9, and they disappear. No one knows what's happening to them. Their parents don't know where they are. And they fall under the radar completely, especially of the international community. Tell us a little bit more about that, because, I mean, adults, I can understand being incarcerated to a point, but young boys, there's got to be, it makes me so angry. It's like a volcano inside of me. So if we could start with that.
Yeah, first of all, I can completely validate your anger. It makes me angry as well when you see such young boys, youth, being arrested, interrogated, incarcerated, and put to trial. The way to understand this is that the military court system is not a court system like we are used to thinking of in our civilian justice systems and in our states. It's an instrument of imposing the apartheid system that governs the West Bank and the Gaza Strip to a certain extent. Now it's a little different between them. But these young boys are considered by Israeli authorities as part of the Palestinian resistance, as potential terrorists. And every act that involves any political or violent, to an extent, resistance, like throwing stones, like participating in demonstrations, is considered criminal.
So age is never a factor.
Age is a factor. Legally, it is a factor. Mm. Legally, children under the age of 11 cannot be detained and are not considered criminally responsible. And there are certain rules about children under 14 and children over 14. There are, to a certain extent, rules that are meant to serve as a better protection for young individuals. But in the eyes of the Israeli military, these are the next generation of Palestinian armed resistance, and therefore they are repressed.
Okay, and Or because I think the number is about 250. The last number I heard, there are around 250 underage young boys in the prisons. Is this number reflective, or we don't know if it is reflective or not?
It is usually reflective of those there are. It is usually reflective of those who are held by the Israeli prison service. And most Palestinian prisoners are held within the Israeli prison service. That organization releases data every 3 months, I think, and the data is generally reliable as to the numbers. There are more detainees that are held by the Israeli military, and that usually is not counted in these numbers. And these numbers fluctuate. You know, every day the number of detainees is different. Every day people are detained. Not every day people are released, but sometimes they are. So these numbers change constantly.
Tell me, Andy, is everyone that is detained taken to court?
No, not at all. Not at all. So there are two categories of detainees that are not taken to court or taken to court only very rarely within their detention. So they are detained without charge. This is what I mean. There are two types of detention without charge.
This reminds me so much of living in under apartheid South Africa with the 180 days detention without trial, the 360 detention without trial, which means you're in there, the key's thrown away, and the minute they release you, you walk around the corner and they detain you again. There's no...
Again. Yeah, exactly. This is a revolving door,
yes,
right? And even as we see Palestinian prisoners now released, for example, in the hostage exchange deal, they could be arrested again tomorrow. So Israel is releasing prisoners, but there's nothing preventing it from detaining and arresting more and more Palestinians. So in that term, it is a revolving door.
The ones that do go to court, do they actually get representation?
Okay, so I was starting to say there are two types of detention without charge. The first is administrative detention. In terms of international law, it's called internment.
Okay.
And that has been practiced by Israel since 1967, since the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Adults, young people, etc. Since 2002, Israel created another category of detention without charge that is called, prepare for this, unlawful combatants.
Oh, so okay. Which means what?
Israel borrowed or adopted the new terms of the American War on Terror and defined militants or terrorists for them who are not under Israeli control, so who do not live or reside in Israel or the West Bank. And they are defined as unlawful combatants, and similar to administrative detention, but a little harsher. They can be detained without charge for a long period of time. Theoretically, indefinitely. Now, both of these detentions without charge are subject to some judicial review.
Okay.
And the difference is that the administrative detainees are subject to judicial review in the military courts in the occupied territories, because in the West Bank. And unlawful combatants is a different story. It currently applies to Palestinians in Gaza. So all the detainees that have been, or most of the detainees that have been arrested during this war from Gaza are defined under Israeli law as unlawful combatants.
Okay.
The judicial review is in Israeli civilian courts because there is no military court in Gaza anymore after the disengagement, which doesn't mean that it's better. So they are only subject to judicial review every 6 months, and they are held as a different category in the prison service. And as we heard over the last year, they've been subject to horrific treatment,
torture,
including torture and ill-treatment and starvation and other means.
And rape?
Yeah.
Okay. And when they do go to court, when they're the ones that are charged, that are not there without charge, do they actually go through a transparent system? Are they actually giving a fair chance, or is it iconically that they're given a trial? Does the trial actually take place? Is it a real trial without charge in the military courts?
Well, in detention without charge, there's no trial.
Yes, okay, that one we
There
know.
is no trial. Yeah, there's a judicial review. There's an order by a military commander or the security service saying this person is dangerous because he is an activist in the whatever student organization or Palestinian Islamic Jihad or any type of organization, and then a military judge, which is not independent, in a system that is not independent and is not transparent, looks at some memo from the security service and says, yes, I approve this order for detention. There's another whole class of cases which are considered criminal cases, and there are charges, and in principle there are evidence and there is a trial. But again, the system of military courts is not independent, not transparent. It's based on interrogations by the security service that very often produce confessions that are given under conditions of ill treatment and torture or other ways of pressure. And there's actually very rarely a real trial. It's a system that is meant to encourage plea bargaining, and that keeps people in detention as the default. So in most of the cases, it's better to plea bargain. You would spend less time in prison if you plea bargain than if you actually go to trial. And that creates a system of actually plea bargains and over 99% of convictions.
Another question, I mean, I'm getting horrified the more I hear, but another question is, if my son was arrested and he was 12 or 13, would I, and he was arrested without charge, would I know about it?
Eventually you would.
Would I know about it, and would I know where they'd taken him? Because I assume there isn't just one prison.
No, there isn't just one prison, and you would eventually be able to find out, but you would not get a notice, you know, promptly or when he is detained on, you know, you would not get a phone call saying, this is, we are holding your son, this is where he is, et cetera, et cetera. The entire status of families is not, let's say, streamlined into the military system, and families are often desperate to know where their children are. They only know that they were taken by the military. And there are NGOs who like have these hotlines where you can call, and they will call the military and they will find out and they will tell you, or you will call some kind of a coordination office and find out this way or another.
Okay. At least there is a system, not the best one, but there is. Let's move on to the third thing, and this question of an apartheid state. Now, being an ex-South African, I'm still South African born, and having lived through that system, what I see cannot be described as anything else but an apartheid system. But from reading some of the research that I went through and some of the things that you had written, the apartheid can be defined in it, put in different categories. It can be an apartheid state. It's defined differently in the state of Israel and differently in the occupied territories, or sometimes all over.
Well, it just depends on the approach that people take when they use this term. One approach sees only what is happening in the occupied territories as apartheid, separating or creating a racialized hierarchy between settlers and Palestinians in the West Bank. So that is the narrower approach to the apartheid paradigm. The other approach looks at the entire territory of Israel and Palestine as an apartheid regime, saying over this entire territory, there is a racialized oppressive hierarchy where Jewish citizens are on top and Palestinians in different status categories are all repressed.
Mm.
So starting from Palestinian citizens of Israel who also suffer systemic discrimination, Palestinians in East Jerusalem who are residents but not citizens and are subject to a whole different system regulating their status. They can lose their status in East Jerusalem. There are Palestinians in the West Bank and Palestinians in Gaza. And each one of these groups is governed by different rules, and they are all, to different degrees, subject to the Jewish supremacy of Jewish citizens.
Which, by definition, is apartheid.
Which, by definition, is apartheid. I should say, though, that I don't use the term apartheid state, and I prefer to talk about it as an apartheid regime.
Okay.
So that's the political regime, because an apartheid state to some groups today means that we can get rid of apartheid only by getting rid of the state. So the state doesn't have a right to exist if it's an apartheid state. The entire state is criminal. And using the term apartheid regime, saying that the political regime of the state is criminal and illegal, but we can solve this or remedy this or transform this by changing the regime. So what is needed is a regime change and not the obliteration of the state.
I think that's the fairer definition, because the state is there and its existence is not in question,
mm-hmm.
Which Ms. Albanese keeps on having to repeat when she keeps asking this question, does Israel have a right to exist? So it is the regime and the legislation that needs to change, but it's not the state per se. Okay. Let's go to the next thing. We keep on seeing resolutions, and I'm living in Cyprus, and I've seen UN, United Nations Security Council resolutions put into place. We see the ICJ putting resolutions into place. Nothing actually changes. And it breaks my heart to say this, because I have always been, international law has always been part of my life. And considering that I studied in the late 70s and 80s, it was not a big thing then. I always believed in the global community. How can it be implemented? What needs to change to it being implemented? Or am I being totally negative? And yes, it is being implemented up to a certain point.
Well, international law just works differently than domestic laws. There is no international police, there's no international government, and the implementation of international law to a large degree is dependent on the cooperation of states and on international organizations or international institutions, let's say. So it is true that international law is not implemented in the way that we would like it to be. And it is a constant challenge in international law to create compliance. But it is also not true that nothing changes. Let's take the last year, for example. The International Criminal Court has issued arrest warrants against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Minister of Defense, Yoav Gallant. Yes. So they are not behind bars. They're not brought to trial, but there is an international arrest warrant against them. What does it mean? It means that they're not traveling to Europe. If they would travel to Europe or to any of the Latin American countries or the African countries that are members in the International Criminal Court, they risk
being
detention,
arrested.
Being arrested.
I agree with you. I mean, it was a really landmark decision that they arrested the rest, they issued the arrest warrants.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was unexpected to a lot of us. Anticipated, but unexpected.
Yeah, I agree. It really was a brave act by this court and this prosecutor, and they did their job according to international law and withstood much pressure
Yes.
that was put on them. And the pressure is only building up. So now the Trump government is issuing sanctions against the court, and there's a whole battle. We are in the midst of a battle over the role of international law in the international community. And what critical people like you and me and people who care about human rights and global justice need to understand that with all the criticism we have towards the implementation of international law has a vision that we can agree with and that we can work towards. And at this moment, there's a battle over the possibility, even the legitimacy of international law in the world.
Yes.
And we should support international institutions and the implementation of international law against the isolationist and, honestly, racist and imperialist powers that are, from their perspective, they aim to destroy the system of international law and international institutions that are at play today.
I mean, when I think of the threats against the ICJ and against Antonio Guterres and against Mrs. Albanese, who I think should have been Woman of the Year last year, not Woman, Person of the Year last year, I think to myself, what would happen if those institutions weren't in place?
Exactly.
Or would we be going back to the Middle Ages where there was just chaos and it was like being in the jungle, the rule of the strong, the mightiest rule, so the rest just have to cave in or give in, or you starve them. So I agree with you. That's why, despite my lack of optimism, to me, a world without international law should not be a possibility. Because it's a moral basis. It's a barometer of a certain type of morality and a collectivity and respect that no one should have to live without. No country should have to live without.
So what's important to understand about international law, that it provides us with standards.
Mm.
Standards of humanity and of legality in the world community. And even if these standards are not implemented, they are important as standards.
Mm.
We could struggle for their implementation through the institutions that are in place. But B, we have the language and the ability to say this is wrong. Apartheid is wrong. Mm. Ethnic cleansing or deportation is wrong. Genocide is wrong. And international law gives us this language that has been legitimized by the international community for us to be able to stand on the shoulders of this entire system and say that thing is wrong and mobilize people against it. And if we didn't have international law, it would be much, much harder. So this has to be appreciated, and international law should not be judged only on the basis of implementation, which is problematic, of course.
I guess the mere fact that there is no mechanism of accountability is problematic, but there's no way that there can be accountability. I agree with you and that there have been changes, but I think the thing that a lot of us are finding challenging is that there are so many conflicts worldwide and so many illegalities, or illegality is not the word that worries me. Lack of humanity is the word that's worrying me. Because all these
atrocities,
I mean, women getting raped or people being starved or children going to war. I mean, these things should not be happening. And this worries me of what can we do to support this?
We can all organize and mobilize around these ideas and around the demands to stop the war, to stop the genocide, to arrest the war criminals, to stop collaborating with apartheid and genocide, to stop supplying arms and weapons to this war machine, and build movements and inform publics who are interested in this and inform diplomats and governments about what is going on so they can mobilize and create political power against these atrocities that are happening. But I also want to say another thing, and you don't often hear that, but every state has a criminal justice system, okay, and a police and a criminal law. And no one expects that because the law or the institutions exist, murders will stop, rapes will stop, theft will stop, corruption will stop. This is part of human nature.
Yes.
I mean, violence and unlawful behavior is part of society wherever we live. Mm. And no one expects that if the law and the institutions exist, this will never happen, ever. For some reason, there's that expectation in the international community that this should not happen at all. And it is used to slam international law. Oh, it doesn't do anything because this keeps going on. There's no world without wars. I hate to break you the news. There will not be a world without wars. But we are trying, and I hope we will succeed to minimize the instances where this happens, to protect civilians as much as we can, and to condemn and build political power against that. And this is what we're doing through the system of international law.
We've got to use it to try and maintain some semblance of normalcy, because I agree with you. We all look in horror at what Elon Musk is doing with Trump, assuming... Yeah. That it's the first time it has ever happened. But it's not the first mm-hmm. time money has trolled any government. It's just now it's a little bit more visible. Okay? It's in your face with social media. But I think it's what you say. We mustn't, we're not looking for perfection. We must be looking at something that is accountable and controllable. Is that the word?
Accountable.
Okay. Tell me, as far as international law goes, how do you see it affecting the war, the conflict, especially now in Gaza and Israel? Because I think it's reached a stage that we are seeing them breaking the ceasefire on both sides, okay? It's not just the Hamas, it's also the Israelis. We're seeing people are continuing to die. There's starvation, the attack on the media and on the humanitarian. What part of international law can we do to make it stronger? Because it's not possible to see what's happening in Palestine, and we mustn't forget that Palestine is not unique, because something similar is happening in the Sudan. Mm-hmm. And something similar is happening in Yemen, and something similar is happening in Myanmar and in Haiti. What is something that we can do as international lawyers, but also as civilians, because I think the biggest outrage from civil society is this lack of humanity and the lack of accountability. Is there any suggestion? Do you have any suggestions? Or any ideas? Suggestions is a strong word. Any ideas?
Yeah, well, I think important work is being done. And the fact that there are actors like the Israeli government and the Israeli military that international law, as we understand it, doesn't play any role for them. They reinvent an international law that they think they are abiding by, but it's a very creative and destructive invention. The important work that is being done is to document, mm-hmm. to document what is happening on the ground, to analyze it, which is the work of many, both media and international human rights and local human rights organizations, and to bring those evidence, this documentation, to the public, to world governments, and to international institutions.
Okay.
The documentation and analysis, and it happens all the time. We don't notice it, right? We watch the media. What we are watching is people documenting and analyzing and bringing us the facts that everyone should know.
And I agree. We tend to see these little clips on Twitter, on Facebook, or short articles, but we don't realize that there is a lot of work being done that we don't know about. What can mm-hmm. we do? Because I have to say, Mrs. Albanese, I don't know where she finds the energy. Okay. And I also think she must have protection because I'm sure her life has been threatened. What can we do to support her? The only thing I know of doing is I keep on retweeting her tweets or things she writes or agreeing with it. Is there anything else we can say? Because she truly is the voice of accountability and humanity, because she's not taking sides, she's looking at what's happening on the ground. Is there anything we can do to support her? Because, I mean, as I said, I don't know where she finds the energy.
Yeah, well, I think supporting her publicly is the important thing that we can do, and staying aware and alert into what is happening. So when she was accused of anti-Semitism, I and other Jewish colleagues signed a petition saying we don't find what she's doing anti-Semitic, and it's actually an attempt to silence her. So we can be aware, alert, and support her publicly in cases that she's unjustly attacked, and this is happening all the time.
Exactly.
I should say, if anyone who is of the means who is listening, this entire position of Special Rapporteur of the United Nations is not fully funded by the United Nations. Special Rapporteurs are independent experts. The UN only covers some of their expenses in doing this job, very, very little of it, and the rest of it is actually dependent on fundraising. She's not doing that all the time because it's not her main job, but behind the scenes, these people have to fundraise in order to support what they are doing.
I know
So
she's
if there
being very
are
careful because they have, she knows she's under the microscope of where the funding is coming from. So I know she's, I saw some reports, some of that, she's very careful about her funding. And she always has the books open of where all the money's coming from because she can easily be accused of taking money from Hamas or the Iranians or the Saudi Arabians. So I agree with you, maybe finding a way to support her financially because I know she doesn't get a salary per se. Okay, that's a good way. Tell me, can you tell me the, because the other word that confuses me, or not confuses me, is the use, the anti-Semitism we know, the word Zionist. It's often misused or used, underused. Can you define that word for me? Because I know, to me, the Zionist I knew and the anti-Semite I knew when I was growing up was not such an aggressive word. It was a lover of, it wasn't a word to, it wasn't an insult. It wasn't used as a sword. It's changed.
Yeah, you're pointing to something really, really critical, that the meaning of Zionism in popular discourse has changed over the years. And in many circles in the left currently, it's the word Zionist is used as an insult or as a slur even, to describe people who support genocide. So the assumption is that the Zionists are committing the genocide. So if you're a Zionist, you are a supporter of genocide. That is not a fair and correct interpretation in all cases. Of course, there are Zionists who support genocide, but not everyone who self-identifies as Zionist supports genocide. Can I define the term for you? Yes, I can. But we first need to understand that different people are using this word while they interpret that differently. So whenever someone says, I'm a Zionist, or he's a Zionist, or she's a Zionist, tell me what you mean by that. Tell me what you mean by that. Many people use that word to express their positive emotion towards Israel. So they are
They were supporting
connected.
you. They were supporting the
Yeah.
existence of the state of Israel.
That's right. And when you ask them, well, are you for a state system that systematically discriminates Palestinians? They would say, no, of course not. I did not. I do not support that. But I do feel that the state of Israel should exist. So there is a range of meanings that is attributed to that term. When I say Zionism, I refer to the political movement of Jews defining themselves as a nation with the right to self-determination.
Okay, that's the word, that's the understanding I know.
But it is true that the Zionism that is currently practiced by the State of Israel is a version of Zionism that we should condemn, that creates a systematic discrimination and a racialized hierarchy where Jews are, where Jewish supremacy is being perpetrated, promoted against Palestinians all the time. And this is how Zionism has, in fact, transformed into apartheid.
Yeah.
And today, the Zionism that is, in fact, operated by the State of Israel equals apartheid, equals ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And, you know, I do not define myself as a Zionist in every term that you'd want to use, but I do think that there's a lot of misunderstanding around this term.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with social media has destroyed the English language as it is, because in social media you'll find the word Semitic and Zionism used as an insult.
Mm-hmm.
You're not a good Jew, you're not a Zionist, is a bad Jew, because it means you want me dead if I'm Palestinian.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's so these were these are, and I mean I like words, and I think we have to be so careful when we use them, but these two words are intended to incite. When they're used online or used in the public narrative, they're not intended to say what you say, that I identify as a Jew and the right to my right to have a state and self-determination.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yes, I think that originally there's a sense in using the term Zionist if it is meant to differentiate those who are supporting the Israeli state project with all of the atrocities that it perpetrated from Jews. So not all Jews are Zionists, and we are not putting the blame or the responsibility for the State of Israel on all of the Jews. Of course, that is right. We only want to ascribe it to that group that supports the State of Israel and what it's doing. But using the term Zionist then does not solve the problem, because there are many people who would self-identify as Zionists while not supporting what the State of Israel is currently doing or has been doing in the past decades. So speaking about just Israel,
yes,
the Israeli government and what it is doing is the fair, I think, way to challenge and resist Israeli crimes.
Can I take on to another subject and tell me if you can talk about it? The settlers. I find the way the Israeli government uses the settlers and pushes them into places, it reinforces the expansionist policy. And there again, you also see the state treats in West Bank, they treat the settlers differently to what they treat the Palestinians. And lots of friends of mine have friends in the West Bank. They will be beaten by settlers, and the Israeli army will be watching and letting it happen.
Yeah.
So how do you see the role of the settlers in this whole conflict? Where does it fit? How has it made it worse? Because it has made it worse.
Yes,
is it a
has
big subject?
Made it worse.
Mm-hmm.
It is a big subject. What's important to understand is that settler violence is systematic. It's not an individual thing. It constantly happens. And just like you said, it is supported by the Israeli military and the Israeli state. So settlers are individuals in some cases. In other cases, they are enlisted into the Israeli military, and currently the Israeli military has many settlers in it. but they are acting as a state-adjacent group, actually furthering state violence to Palestinians without any restraints, limitations, accountability. They're actually supported and encouraged by state institutions to act in this way. So settler violence is part of state violence in Israel, Palestine currently. And we should understand that this is part of the settler colonial project. It is a settler colonial project, and therefore the settlers are the ones implementing this settler colonial violence that is meant to take over land and expel Palestinians and replace them in this territory.
Our mutual friend Marina actually sent me the link of a YouTube movie that's at the movie that's on YouTube about this whole process of how the settlers have been allowed to, by each president, prime minister, they've been allowed to just get in and often do the work of the state. They just allow
Yes,
that,
and
and they get away with murder, literally.
they actually are given the weapons to commit the murders. So the weapons of settlers that is supposedly to protect their settlement is provided by the Israeli military. They are giving them the guns. So it is part of state violence that masquerades itself as individual law breaking, but it is part of the state project.
And it also reinforces the idea of apartheid because it's
Oh,
within the.
absolutely.
We're coming to the end. Is there anything you would like to talk about before we close or like to mention that before we close? I know it's difficult to be positive because the whole situation in the area is of great concern, and I'm a stone throw away. The day Hezbollah bombed the embassy in Damascus, we could see it. So we're very close by, and I'm sure we're also breathing in all the bombs and things that are being thrown in Gaza and in the area. I'm sure it's coming in the way. So is there anything you'd like to say before we close? Because there's so many more questions I want to ask, but I think we've covered a lot of stuff. And
Well, I think of course it is and has been horrific that we have been witnessing this genocidal war for over a year. And we must have the moral clarity to condemn it in the most serious ways and work towards ending it and rebuilding and rehabilitating Gaza and getting it back to life. Politically, we are definitely in a crossroads. So this is a constitutive moment that will, in many ways, determine the future of Palestine, of Israel, and of in the conflict of the region. And in global terms, it's a dark moment with the Israeli extreme right-wing government, with the American extreme right-wing government. But we must understand that what we do at this period is crucial, and we have to speak up. And it's hard not to be paralyzed by these dark powers who have taken over. But the only solution or the only way forward is collaborations between Israelis and Palestinians who understand that
There is no
eight
other
million
way.
Jews,
There is no
eight
other way.
million Jews, yeah, 8 million Jews and 8 million Palestinians on the land of Palestine are going nowhere, and they need to find ways to live together peacefully. And Israel must relinquish its illegal and oppressive control, and we must model the possibility of doing things otherwise. That Jews and Arabs are not existential enemies who would always fight and kill each other. That is not true. There are so many spaces where Israeli Jews and Palestinians collaborate, act in solidarity, and show us what we personally know from these collaborations, that we can live together. And we must build a better future for ourselves. So I just want to highlight these spaces, these organizations, like the ones that I am working with, B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization, Academia for Equality, an organization of Israeli academics, both Jews and Palestinians, who are working together, and all the other spaces where we are collaborating and trying to create a better future for all of us.
I must agree with you. I also am in touch with the Woman Waging Peace and the Woman of the Sun. I think a lot of the NGOs on the ground, whether they be women or patients' rights or resources-based, they have worked together. They are working together. It's something that, coming from Cyprus, where we have Turkish Cypriots and Greek Cypriots, and you've got the Turks and the Greeks and the British all around us, we have to work back to that. There are spaces where we have worked together, we are working together, and we must continue working together. We just need to broaden it out a bit. Because I agree. If I think of the world that I'm leaving for my son and his generation, unless we stand together and remind people and remind ourselves constantly, we are not enemies. We need to live together. We don't need to agree on everything. We just need to learn to work together and respect each other, whether we agree or not. Respect each other's right to exist and be.
Yeah, and we need a lot of creativity and a lot of steadfastness in this moment to say there are other possibilities. We can imagine other futures. So if I can remind several other initiatives, the Forum for Regional Thinking that I am part of in the Van Leer Institute in Jerusalem has just published a paper about possible solutions and not so much about possible solutions, but about a possible and viable peacemaking Israeli policy. And an organization called A Land for All is promoting some kind of a, let's say, Confederate solution that is between a one state and a two state, where the two peoples can live together. And this organization, those two organizations also have Israeli Jews and Palestinians collaborating in imagining these future visions. So I think this is the work we should invest ourselves in. And those who are not from the region, it's helpful to learn about these initiatives and to amplify them to the broader world community.
You will send me the links and I will upload them when I upload this podcast. Okay.
Absolutely, I will.
I agree with you. We really need to remember that we can work together. We can exist together. We don't need to kill each other. This is one planet, one space. No one's going to get rid of the other one.
No, we gotta get out of the zero-sum game mentality.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Smadar, thank you very much. I've learned so much during this conversation. Thank you very much for clearing up a lot of stuff that I wasn't sure about and I needed clarity. I'm sure a lot of people around me are in the same position. And look forward to having another conversation, because I think conflict, international law, we've got to push this issue of international law. We need to have a moral compass in everything we do. There needs to be accountability. It doesn't mean everyone's going to adhere to it, but there has to be a global accountability. We are a global community.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
So thank you very much for being with us. Thank you to the listeners who will be listening to this.
Thank you for your important work.
And we will be in touch. And stay safe. Bye.
Thank you. Bye. You too. Bye. Bye-bye.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus, Island Talks. Open, diverse, free.